All right. It's not three people who are actually like watching you laughing at your freaking browsing history. All right. Welcome to another episode of Increments. Vaden, what is your credence that I am a magical being from the seventh dimension that has the ability to grant you 10 Neurips papers if you just put my name on all of them?
I would say my credence is 10 to the negative 6. Oh, God. People are going to have no idea what the hell we're talking about, man. But I love it. But they will soon. They will soon. Yeah, so we're foreshadowing slightly the forthcoming episode on long-termism. But that's not what we're talking about today. Today, we're just doing like a little odds and ends, loose ends episode. This is following our previous conversation on social media, the effects of social media.
Yeah, I think I framed it like we were going to get together and have a giant debate, and I had many more bones to pick with you. And then I came out of the gate, not running, but slowly walking on all fours, ready for you to just kick me down. So
it's hard to like tell back and forth jokes when you have lag.
Yes.
I don't frankly have too much to say, but maybe just tell the audience what is coming next. So we have this one, then we have an episode coming about mental health, and then an episode after that is on long-termism. You and I are both writing some pieces criticizing the recent working draft by Hillary Greaves and William McCaskill. And so hopefully the episode will correspond to putting those online. So some good stuff coming in the pipeline, just to tell people what's coming next. Yeah. But besides that, I don't have too much else to say. What about you?
Hells yeah, no. Roll it.
What are your thoughts on the previous conversation?
Yeah, so it does seem like we possibly have some disagreements just about empirical stuff, but I think it remains to be seen exactly where we disagree there. Maybe I'm strawmanning your claims a little bit, but I've got to say, God damn it, this is getting annoying, but like, I think you really shifted my mind, or at least changed the perspective that I hold on social media. And just, yeah, taking a step back, it's funny because I often find myself at odds politically with like, you know, friends and people in general. Right? I think there's like a tendency to always think you're living at like the worst moment in history, right? Like, how did things get so bad? And there's always people with sort of like apocalyptic visions of the present moment, right? Like, we're living through uniquely bad times right now, and everything is degrading around us, and the earth is rising up, and it's terrible. And if we make it past this century, it'll be a miracle. And in general, I pride myself on being able to calmly and soberly step past this kind of rhetoric, you know, and, you know, read arguments like Pinker's arguments and whatnot, and am able to like calmly reason about how good the world is right now, and step past all my confirmation and availability biases and stuff. But it was so clear to me in listening to our last conversation that I was just like wrong about a lot of like, or at least overblowing a lot of the concerns and overblowing a lot of the fears, and like was taking stances on things that just aren't like empirically backed up at this point, just because how I like subjectively feel about it. So anyway, the last episode was a very good lesson in humility for me, just being like, fuck, I fell into the exact same trap that people do all the time, where you like have this thing in front of you. And it's a problem, and the problem seems so compelling and so urgent, and you think this is a unique problem, and I, you know, this is uniquely bad for this and this reason. It's devastating the social order in which we live, and society is crumbling. It was clear to me, it was clear to me in listening to that conversation, like, oh my God, like, yeah, I did it. I totally slipped into these, like, apocryphal visions of how bad of the society descending into chaos. So I guess, yeah, my first thought was just like, thank you for enlightening me, as painful as that is to admit.
I expected much more of a disagreement this conversation.
Yeah, so but, I mean, that's not to say, yeah, I think we still do have some disagreements and there's some areas to explore, but yeah, I did find it fascinating, like how much my mind has changed over the course of like a few days and just like listening to the draft episode and stuff. And so I just think the general move of not looking at like all the problems something has, but looking at which problems it's solved and trying to situate any new developments and new technologies in their proper historical context is like such a powerful and important perspective to bring to bear on any problem. And I think, you did that really well. And that's not to say I don't think there's like massive problems, a lot of which I outlined in the last episode, but just to think about like, okay, how is this actually worse than what came before it? And like, how do we think about this in terms of just the progression of like where we're going and where we're trying to get to? And when you take that sort of perspective, sort of the apocalyptic calls that are deeming this technology the worst thing to have happened to us just sort of like fall by the wayside pretty quickly, I think. And then once you start allowing yourself to have that perspective, then you really start to realize like all the benefits that this technology is conferring on us. And so, you know, like right after that conversation, I had an event with like Giving What We Can, which is just like this charitable organization, and was like emceeing an event and just realized like, fuck, like these people couldn't get together and we couldn't have this conversation if it wasn't for the ability for us to organize and stuff on Facebook. And so, you know, all these important, meaningful aspects of my life that are actually due to you know, the positive effects of social media, I was like completely overlooking that. And forgetting that like it's not just political discourse that happens on some of these platforms, right?
I think of it as maybe a illustration of the power of certain rhetoric. And I'm not going to harp on documentaries again, but like when we talk about emotional valences and stuff, and having actors act out and dramatize the seriousness of certain subjects, like people do it because it's effective. It's a very effective way to convey certain ideas. And it's just a nice reminder that we have to constantly be expressing ourselves to people who think differently because we keep each other in check, right? Like the whole point of having a podcast between you and I is to express tentative ideas and have the other person kind of sanity check it, right? And so there's no really winning or losing. There's just this constant mutual error correction through conversation, which is illustrated in kind of in the subject. But the other thing I was thinking about recently is like the target, so social media, the target of say Tristan Harris and it's so bloody large. Like it is such a huge phenomenon that it's really hard to see everything at the same time. I think Sam said that once, but given that it's such a large phenomenon, I think one thing we can default to is technology isn't adopted widely unless it fills an important niche. So it's very rarely that a technology will be widely used and it is objectively making everybody's lives worse. So people tend to use it precisely because it improves their lives. So locally, people make these certain decisions. And that signal, just the very fact that it is so ubiquitous, I think is often neglected when we think about the effect of the technology as a whole.
Yeah, interesting. I would imagine the pushback there is what you have at the beginning is a bunch of people like signing up for a service and doing it completely willingly because it benefits them in some way. But over time, if enough people are on it, then the cost, you know, and perhaps like the platform changes over time to become like net negative, say like your time spent on it is net negative. But if it's so ubiquitous that like all your friends are on it, you incur like a big personal cost leaving it. Because for example, like, you know, maybe you're missing business opportunities, even not advertising on Facebook, say. And so not being there, you're not up to date on the news, you're not staying in contact with friends and stuff. And so there is this weird prisoner's dilemma of like, it's possible that if everyone left Facebook for a service, for a competing service that didn't have the same algorithmic underpinnings that Facebook has chosen to adopt, it would make everyone's lives better. But just like as a lone actor, it's not in your best interest to just leave on your own, you know?
Yeah, I guess, well, that's why we have competition, right? And so there's like, again, social media isn't a singular thing. There's different platforms that have different strengths and weaknesses, and they're all competing for people's time and attention. And that isn't necessarily a negative thing. That could be a way to motivate the improvement of certain products. And let's not forget that like this prisoner's dilemma, tragedy of the commons kind of phenomenon was around with Nexopia. I guess many of our listeners won't remember what Nexopia is, but at least in Calgary, Alberta, where you and I grew up, Nexopia was like the platform that all of our friends were on. And then a few of us moved over to something better, Facebook, and then it was a superior product. But the moving over was a way to get out of, like, is a existence proof that people can get out of these tragedies and tragedies of the commons and stuff. But
yeah, I guess. I mean, do you not think there's a certain monopoly effect with Facebook? Like, Nexopia was just not at the same scale that Facebook is. Nexopia did not command 3 billion users, I don't think.
The company of Facebook or the technology of Facebook? Because Facebook found Instagram a threat because Instagram offered a very different product.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have such a monopoly that they were able to prevent the technology of Instagram from being developed. And instead, they recognized that there is, again, a new niche to be filled. And I guess I see all these technologies as filling niches. Like the view of mankind that I have is that most people are in a better position to determine what's good for them than, say, we are, which isn't to say people are perfect reasoning agents, but in general, you can trust people to make decisions that are better for themselves. And so if people move from Facebook to Instagram or Instagram to Twitter or Twitter back to Facebook, it's because there's different niches and different needs that are not being adequately fulfilled by the various technologies, and these niches will continue to be present, and new technology will continue to fill these gaps. And so maybe it's a naively pro-technology view that I hold, but I just view technology as just applied problem solving. And so to reject problem solving seems to be a little bit misguided. So
yeah, do you want to talk about the asymmetry of power a little bit? Or like, do you buy into this this model at all?
So I think that there obviously is an asymmetry of power in one sense. Twitter is a good example because Twitter is now putting disclaimers on most of Donald Trump's tweets. Donald Trump doesn't have the power to take these disclaimers off. And so there's a deep asymmetry there. But particularly when people talk about asymmetries, they tend to talk about it in terms of like the attention grabbing aspect. Facebook has supercomputers and Facebook has just billions and billions of data points in order to keep your attention. And that claim I don't find to be terribly persuasive because it's not as if they have a supercomputer dedicated to Vaden and a supercomputer dedicated to Ben and a supercomputer dedicated to John. It's that they have to try to predict the actions of their entire user base. And therein lies the difficulty of the problem. So the supercomputers aren't pointed at our brains. They're pointed at this hugely difficult problem, which is trying to find signal in this noise. So the asymmetry, I think, disappears when you view the resources as tackling a huge problem, which is trying to make the service usable. So, okay, so this is one new thought that I had between last conversation and this conversation. So like one of the big charges against Facebook is that it like just like serves us up outrage, which I'm beginning to think is a bit of a fairy tale. I think that what it does is it serves us up content that we want to see. And I was talking to my dad about this, and he said, well, like we could make a product that just is completely neutral, that doesn't serve up any content to any particular person. It just is like a first come, first serve. This would be a terrible product. This would be a product nobody wants to use. You can tell this by just randomly selecting one of your friends on Facebook, and most of the content on there is not interesting. And so this like recommender system serving us up stuff that we want to see is, I think, mainly to get like a minimum viable product because there's so much content available. If they didn't have this, then people would hate the service. People wouldn't use it, right? And then you can say that it's serving us up outrage, but it's just serving us up like stuff that we're interested in. And sometimes we're interested in outrage. Sometimes there's things to be outraged about. But like throughout our previous conversation, there is a this claim that like Facebook, the whole point of it and the whole point of social media is just to serve us up outrage, to get constantly more and more outraged. And I don't think this is true. I think that it will serve us up things that we engage with. And sometimes we engage with outrageous material, but other times we engage with cute material, and other times we engage with material which our friends have liked. And like, I just looked at my Facebook wall and I don't actually see much outrage. I see much more outrage on Twitter. And so we can compare the and contrast the two. But I think that there's just a lot of assumptions that are just taken for granted in the social dilemma, that that when we actually think about, like, is it true? I don't know if it actually is. So the asymmetry thing, I think, is mainly about making a minimum viable product. And then we could describe it as all the sensational phrases that they tend to use. But if we just, like, step back, I think it's mainly just trying to make a product which people will actually use.
Yeah, yeah. What's striking, I guess, is looking at the documentary, you realize that they don't give suggestions for how it should look, which seems like a huge red flag for me, right? They're just, like, pointing out problems without proffering any solutions. And I'm becoming recently, I don't know whether it was a product of this conversation or just, you know, all our conversations, but I'm becoming incredibly fed up with whatever medium, whether it's people, podcasts, whatever, just cynically trying to, like, take down all these elements of the status quo without offering solutions.
Fucking so, exactly, Ben.
just like to give a random fucking example that I heard recently. Have you heard of the Chapo Trap House podcast?
Yes. Yeah. It's like extreme left. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously this demonstrates how far away I am from understanding pop culture, but I had, like, just ran across them the other day, and I listened to one of their episodes, and all it is like four or five guys just complaining about the status quo and calling everyone they disagree with stupid. But obviously, you know, they do this with big words, so it makes them sound smart, and people are like, oh, they understand me, they understand the discontent that I live with. But I'm listening to this and I'm like, this is fucking, like, this is just garbage. You know how easy it is to sit there rail against the system and, like, not provide any real solutions?
Yes.
And at one point, one of them literally says, you know, if we don't do anything about this, we're just going to keep sliding into the well of despair that we've been sliding into for the past, you know, 100 or 200 centuries. And I was just like, I don't know if I just couldn't handle it. I was like, either you're just ignorant of history or you're just trying to make a rhetorical point. You know, I'll choose to hope that it's the latter. But, like, you know, things have been getting so much better, you know, and, like, just yeah. to like sit back and just, you know, it's not hard to criticize things. Like, that's my main point. That's my main argument. It's like, and criticism, you know, is great. But if all you're going to do is just, like, criticize and criticize and criticize and not proffer any solutions, not provide any, like, creative ideas for how we might make things better, like, I just have limited time for like whining, you know. I can't handle it anymore.
Fuck, I agree with you so much, brother, like, so much. And it's why I was so attracted to Tristan Harris on his first appearance on Sam's podcast. So, like, he mentioned the Snapstreak thing, that it's a particularly pernicious design choice, right, that they made, right, and I was like, oh, that's constructive. So you could imagine him bringing this to some CEO, and they say, yeah, that's a good point. Let's remove that. And it's a criticism with the intention of making a better product, right, yeah, and making a product which more people want to use. But that's very different than this, like, overarching despair and hatred for everything, and you just hate it all, and you want to destroy all of it. And yeah, like, that's why this the themes of incrementalism versus, like, radical change run right through technology too, because, again, it's just the difference between people who point out problems in order to solve them and try to make the world better,
yeah,
and people who point out things in order to try to destroy
yeah,
and just undo and reverse. And obviously that's the extreme ends of the spectrum. But I think what I heard in your comments was just, like, you're starting to notice this in other domains, and how this,
yeah,
this worldview can just become this 24-hour constant whine about everything. and it's not a constructive way to improve. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just listening to Bert Ekman's, Great Courses Plus on how Jesus became God. And he starts the book talking about, like, the apocalyptic tradition in Judaism. So, and, like, this is one of the going theories for, like, what Jesus was. Like, he's subscribed to this, like, apocalyptic vision, and hence all the references to, like, you know, this is the last life of of man on this earth, and like, you know, God will return soon and whatnot. And I was like, mother of God, things have not changed. We still just have a bunch of apocalypticists running around just predicting the end of the world just via different means.
Yeah, well, like talking about niches and stuff, like I do think that there is going to be a like a perennial hunger for this, because people see things going wrong in their society and it makes them sad, and like bad news travels way faster than good news, and so there's always going to be a hunger for some answer to why things are going wrong. This is the conspiracy theory view of society, that it's due to bad people, or to generalize it slightly, it's due to some bad thing, and we take care of that thing, then the rest will be taken care of for us. And so it's the desire for silver bullets, which I think is the reason why these people and these ideas keep reoccurring.
So to come back to your actual point, I largely agree with you. I think, though, it is useful to think about not necessarily platforms that would serve you up neutral content, but other forms of content. So, you know, there are multiple things that grab our attention, and we know that outrage is one of them. Here, I think Tristan Harris actually makes like a useful analogy with the car crash example, whereas like we can't help but when we pass a car crash have our attention grabbed by that. But that's not necessarily the thing in retrospect that we would have liked to see. And so there are lots of things that could serve us which would grab our attention. And so it's a matter of like within that landscape, which kind of things are we directed towards? And so some platforms, as you say, are doing this better than others. It sounds like Twitter is not so good at this. So there is room to navigate even once you decide you want to target people's attention, right? There's like different kinds of attention grabbing sources you could promote.
And so it's something interesting, like the comparison between Twitter and Facebook. So they're all obviously collapsed into the single phrase social media when people are attacking it in general. But now that we can like untease these a little bit, like Twitter obviously incentivizes outrage much more than Facebook does. But I kind of go to Twitter for that reason. Like I think there's a time to be outraged, and there's some utility that comes from that, from people making strong arguments against one another. And like the word argument, I always mean it in both senses, both in the sense of like producing novel ideas, but also like arguing. Arguing can be emotional sometimes. It absolutely can be. And so obviously there's a big difference in incentives between Twitter and Facebook, but I don't know if a perfect society would have the outrage dial turned down. I think a perfect society might have one place that you go when you want to be outraged and another place you go when you don't. And I would actually posit that we're maybe kind of close to that, in the sense that Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat aren't places people go when they want to be outraged. Here's a question for you. What would be an appropriate amount of outrage? And how would you know if the outrage dial is turned too high or too low?
Yeah, that's a good fucking question. I'm tempted to give an answer along like the Coleman Hughes answer to how much, like how many police killings are we willing to tolerate? You can't give me a precise number, but presumably the answer is fewer than right now, than the status quo. But there's an extra dimension to the question, which is that obviously, like ideally, there would be no police killings, you know, for just whatever reason, because there's like no crime in society, for example. Whereas outrage also has positive functions, right? And so that is a different dimension. And so, yeah, like you said, there's certain things that we should be outraged about. You know, the current president of the United States will not concede the election, and presumably this should inspire outrage, right? Because it seems like at this point everyone's just tired of his shit, but you know, if this actually continued and he refused to like leave the office, an appropriate response here would be outrage.
And then the question is like, how do you determine what is appropriate to be outraged about? And I think the answer is you can't. We don't have a position to stand to say, well, our outrage is appropriate, but your outrage isn't. We want to turn down the dial on your outrage, but our outrage should be full blast. And so I don't know what to do with this, except that I don't think we can say a priori what is the correct amount of outrage. We just need to give people different spaces, so that if you want to be outraged, you can go to some places, and if you want to be placated, watch cat videos, you can do that too.
I guess my worry is that outrage can sometimes spill over and target populations or subsets of populations that wouldn't otherwise be. So I see, for example, a lot of outrage towards the Trump administration that then spills over to just anyone who has like a preferred right-leaning policy or is just a conservative in general. And then that just prohibits like constructive conversation with people who disagree with you. So when there's intolerance of anyone who disagrees with you, that seems like it's gone too far. But then again, you need to be intolerant of some views, right? Like at the extreme, there's this like paradox of tolerance where you can't be tolerant of intolerance. Otherwise this will crumble the tolerant society. But there are some views that presumably are just like so abhorrent, we just, you know, don't want to put up with them in the public sphere. And that's also a separate question from what is the influence of social media on outrage. So it's particularly easy to see this outrage spilling over and targeting, for example, conservatives in this case, because you can just see people doing it. Whereas that sort of sentiment probably existed before, and you just didn't witness it because it wasn't in public. The question of outrage is like fascinating. Like, when is outrage appropriate? And I just like personally, I have trouble with this a lot, honestly, and, you know, put my political cards on the table. Like, yeah, I'm definitely left leaning. And my intuition is like, we should try and engage in good faith with like people across the aisle who, you know, disagree with us. But there is like a limit to this, right? Like, there are fairly like run of the mill conservatives who just like support Trump because they honestly think his policies would just lead to like a better world for other people. And those kind of people, you want to be able to engage with them, right? They might have something valuable to teach you and you them. But then there's people who support Trump who are just like racist, right? And I'm, you know, less willing to engage in good faith conversation with them. But sorting them out at the beginning is like very difficult. So the tendency, you don't want to label everyone who like supports Trump, for example, as a racist, obviously, but it's hard to get a handle on like what proportion of people this is, you know? And then if you're telling like minorities, like, you know what, you have to be very sympathetic with people who disagree with you and stuff, I'm not sure that's a fair ask, you know? And so I like really struggle in this space of like how much good faith you're supposed to lend people who disagree with you. And what you can ask of people in like personal disagreements, right?
There's a juxtaposition between being outraged and engaging with people, which I think is a false one. I think you can be outraged, and that is the reason you start engaging with people. I think, at least for me, outrage has always been more of like a cold, steely outrage, where I am never typically outraged about person, but I'm outraged about either an event or a set of ideas. So it's very rarely people, but obviously like Trump would be the example to not even make a joke about it. Like, he's obviously is infuriating, but he's a bit of an anomaly. So most of the time I find some injustice in the world that makes me emotional. And then I take these emotions and I channel it into research. And I tend to research quite strongly, particularly when I'm outraged. And ironically enough, but this is the most recent example, the documentary did outrage me. It outraged me in the sense that I think that in general, all it's going to do is cause most of my friends and family to be a little bit more uncomfortable in their day-to-day, a bit more like feeling like they're manipulated, a bit more
susceptible or something.
Susceptible, yeah. And that pissed me off. And it pissed me off so much so that I dedicated a couple weeks to studying it, to studying the phenomenon. And so that was useful. That was useful outrage. And so I guess I want to call it into question the idea that if you're outraged, you can't necessarily engage. Because I think that for me, and I think for a decent amount of people, outrage is the thing which allows them to become interested and become engaged in certain subjects.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I guess the one problem there is like just the susceptibility of humans to something like confirmation bias. So if you're outraged and you're studying to prove your point, presumably it's going to take a lot of really objective evidence to actually change your mind on that point. And so I'm not sure what to do with that. Like, is outrage the best state of mind to have when you actually want to get to the truth of something? Like, you know, if we're all perfectly objective observers, like Faden Masrani, then possibly. But, you know, the rest of us are outraged about something and, you know, fuck the other people. We're gonna prove our point no matter how we do it. I actually think as we talk more, this is like, I think possibly a thread of disagreement the background throughout a lot of our conversation, yeah, which nice. Is just the ability of humans to like, to just be honest with themselves, like in their criticism and in their fallibility. You know, I take the research coming out of cognitive psychology like relatively seriously when it talks about like all these cognitive biases and stuff. And it seems like our ability to be honest with ourselves when it comes to like our views, you know, the reason the scientific establishment is so successful is because it doesn't rely on individuals admitting their own fallibility. It relies on science as an institution pointing out an individual's fallibility. Whether they want to admit it or not is like besides the point, because if everyone else can see it, it doesn't matter if they will admit it, right? And so, yeah, I guess I'm just worried about like the state of mind outrage puts you in when it comes to actually evaluating evidence objectively.
The literature coming out of the cognitive psychology community just taxonomizes the myriad of different ways that human beings are fallible. Great, let's make us slightly less fallible by putting labels on certain weaknesses that we have. But there's nothing to despair there, because it has always been thus. What additional thing does the cognitive psychology literature tell us that we don't already know from fallibilism?
I think it's the inability to recognize our own mistakes. Mm. So you will often like hold to a view even after it's like quite clear that it is untrue or not the view best supported by like the evidence at that point.
So now we're getting to the territory of like, do people change their minds and stuff? And I think that they do. It just often doesn't happen in real time. It often happens gradually over, say, 6 months, where a certain thing that someone said to you, you can't really get out of your head, and it kind of changes your mind slowly. The book that you had read from Megan Phelps Roper, right?
Yeah,
mind was changed on Twitter in the heat of an argument, gradually over time. And it wasn't just a single conversation. It was like changing her mind on her like a fundamental belief that she held. And I think that this happens quite a lot. Like both Sam and Richard Dawkins and Hitchens. And Dan did it. We talk about just being inundated by emails and letters of people who had completely lost their faith based on their arguments. And so I think minds do change. It just happens slowly, and it happens like everything else, fallibly.
Yeah. That one claim about the four horsemen, quote unquote, has always bugged me, because there's no counterfactual to evaluate. Like, who knows if those people were just like on the edge of claiming, changing their mind anyway. Like, you don't know what the distribution of those people's like mind states were beforehand. Like, they might have been changed. They might have had their minds changed like 6 months later by just randomness. They might have changed it on their own. They might have been people who are just like right on the edge of changing their minds anyway. This is definitely a side point, so we don't have to include that. But yeah, I mean, we could talk about the crime thing. I wasn't super happy about how that went,
because I also wasn't terribly clear, so it might be worth clearing up for the audience.
I guess, okay, so let me try and paraphrase your position so that I actually understand what you're saying. If you're just saying there's an, as we learn to use words more and we argue more, there is less of a reliance on violence to do the arguing for us. So there is like an increase as we argue with words more and more, there will be less and less violence. And this is evidenced by the fact that since the Enlightenment, basically, there's been decreasing numbers of violence ever from the world, from the war stage, international war and civil war stage, all the way down to domestic abuse, say. And I think that's right. I guess what I was taking issue with is it's not necessarily clear that social media is like a continuation of this ability to have conversation. So it seems possible without looking at the evidence that social media actually increases violence, because people, for example, are like insanely outraged by what the other side is saying. Mm-hmm. And so the claim that social media is just like extending these forms of conversation is the one I was taking issue with, I guess. Like, it's not immediately clear that social media is just a continuation of this trend towards decreasing violence. And then we got bogged down in like the crime wave of like the 70s and 80s, which I think is like pretty irrelevant because 70s and 80s, you know, the spike and decrease in that was all before social media.
Totally. Yeah. So I think that's a great summary. Yeah. My claim was not as strong as we know social media is a cause of the decrease in violence. It's a bit softer that I think Popper says somewhere that like we let ideas die in our stead, given that the research is so nebulous, given that I think it's in fact not possible to research fully because of how wide and large the thing is. My default assumption, my prior, if I use the word, is
my
to,
God, ladies,
is
and
the default, is to default to more conversation is better. And so that's about as strong as I was going with that claim. Nothing stronger than that. And it just it strikes me as being decently analogous to the video game causes violence claim in the sense that Pinker made the point somewhere that the more people play video games, the less time they have to actually go out and be violent. And so the more people are typing furiously on Reddit comment feeds and tweeting furiously, the less time they have to actually just go out and fight with somebody at a bar.
Right.
This is not shown empirically in the literature. It's more just, I think, decently reasonable to assume, given absence of other information. That's about as strong as I go there. But so this is the other thing. Like, let's imagine hypothetically that the social media platforms were perfectly not manipulative, just exactly as Tristan Harris would like.
Right.
All they did was be a neutral platform to reflect human nature. What do we think they're going to look like?
Right.
Given that human nature is intrinsically tribal and divisive, and the whole edifice of civilization has been to try to damp this down imperfectly, I would posit that they're going to look pretty similar to how they look right now. And then there'll be little nudges here and there, but I think that human nature is by nature rather violent, rather tribal, rather aggressive, rather us versus them. And so social media is going to reflect that because it's, after all, just a reflection of society. It's social media. I put this to you as like a rhetorical question almost, so you don't have to answer it directly. But it's more just, if all we got was a reflection of human nature from all the 7.5 billion people talking at once, I think we're going to see a lot of the same problems that we see. And it's just important, I think, to reflect on when we attribute to social media problems which are actually human nature.
This relates to one of the moves you made in the last episode that really gave me some more perspective on the problem, which was framing it as just not people being divided into echo chambers, but echo chambers coming in contact with one another. And like, what the fuck did we think was gonna happen, right? Like, you have people who are like predisposed to QAnon beliefs coming in contact with like the hyper rationalists, coming in contact with the hyper religious, coming in contact with the hyper leftists. Like, mother of God, it's going to be a battlefield. And so, keeping that in mind, it's like relatively civil, maybe.
Dude, it's such a I think important shift in perspective. Like, we know people are going to fight, and we know people have different information diets, and that is a default state of human beings. And if you have a place where the only thing that happens is echo chambers come in contact, you're going to have bloody seams. Somebody, political scientist, said that civilizations have bloody borders. I think the echo chambers have bloody borders as well. I would almost be more nervous for social media platforms that had nothing but agreement all of the time.
Something is wrong here.
Pure agreement all of the time. Something would be quite amiss. And in fact, like, that's kind of what I saw on Instagram for about like 4 or 5 weeks during the defund the police movement. It was pure agreement from everyone on my Facebook wall, Facebook wall and Instagram. That scared the shit out of me because no one was even thinking about, could they be wrong? It was pure agreement. No conflict, no outrage. Sorry. That was all outrage directed in the same direction from everyone to one thing. And the thing is the system. And so I don't see conflict as necessarily being a bad thing.
Until we did a podcast episode and then didn't release it because we were too scared.
Dude, I remember that one, man. We were like we both were
gearing up for war.
Preparing like we're going to battle.
Yeah, fucking Christ.
Exactly. Okay, so here's one last point that I want to make, which is in the conversation with Stephen Keynes, we talked about privacy, and we haven't talked too much about privacy, but that's a big dimension of this subject as well. And I've made a tiny incremental, I think, improvement in the way that I think about this, and I want to bounce it by you. So I don't know how to think about privacy, except I think that there's one way that we shouldn't think about it because it's wrong, and that's thinking about privacy as like a finite resource that we want to preserve.
Mm.
Something that can be chipped away at, and every time we engage in social media, we are losing a little piece of privacy. So I do think about reputation that way. I think that reputation is almost finite in its capacity, and you want to act in such a way that you don't damage your reputation.
Interesting.
And after you've like chipped away at it a little bit, it's gone, and it's gone forever. And it's very hard to get back. But privacy does not seem to be like this at all. Privacy is something which you can gain and lose. Sometimes you want it, but you don't have it. And other times you have it, but you don't actually want it. There are instances where it's not about the person as much as it is the action. So there's certain actions which people would want to keep private, but not, but to some people, to other people. Right. So I don't know how the hell to think about privacy, but I know that people tend to think of it as something that is being constantly eroded and chipped away at, and that every time they say use Google, their browser history is being tracked, and therefore they're losing some of their privacy. And so they want to cut back on their use of social media and the internet because they feel as if they have a finite amount of this thing. And they every time they use it, they're kind of chipping away at this finite resource, which seems to me to be completely not accurate. So I don't know how to think about privacy, but I know we shouldn't think of it as a finite resource, which we can lose.
Yeah, I guess that seems largely right. Modulo the predictive algorithmics bit that maybe we still disagree with a bit. So regaining privacy might be difficult if you give away so much information that the predictive algorithmics on these platforms can do a pretty good job of still understanding your interests, preferences, locations, things like that.
Nice point.
And so there is an element of like memory embedded in these platforms that like, you know, if I deactivate Facebook for 2 years, sure, I gain privacy for those 2 years because it's like not seeing my location, but it still has a memory of like what I was like as a user, what sort of things I liked, what my preferences were, what sort of advertisements got me to click on them. And so when I log back on, that's like not lost, you know? So there is an element that we can't regain, I think, unless your personality like shifts, which
interesting. No, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about just the fact that data can be kept forever. But is data the same thing as privacy, though? Predicting what you're going to do, I don't know if that's the same as privacy for what you are currently doing or something that you have done.
Yeah.
Right. Like, say, I've been looking at a lot of Fox recently. I wouldn't want, say, my browser history to be broadcast to everybody on my Facebook wall because they don't have the adequate context to know that my looking at Fox is because I'm delighting in seeing my enemies crushed.
Ooh, that's a good point. I mean, that brings up the question of like, is it possible to maintain a private identity in the face of still losing all your data to like a big company? Because what do you care about privacy at the end of the day? Presumably you care about like individuals, probably individuals you know, retrieving certain facts about you. But you don't care, do you care that there's a statistical correlation between you and buying toothpaste at Shoppers Drug Mart that like only an algorithm is going to take advantage of, and no human is actually sitting there evaluating you, unlike they portray in this in the Social Dilemma, right? It's not three people who are actually like watching you laughing at your freaking browsing history.
That is a fascinating point. So so the other piece that was added is it's about other people seeing certain data, right? It's not just the data being collected sitting on some storage system somewhere. Yeah. It's like if some malicious hacker made a browser where you could browse other people's browsing history,
right.
That would be a flagrant abuse of privacy. Yeah. But if the data is collected and it's not publicly available and it's not seen by any other human being,
doesn't matter.
Then yeah. I don't think it's privacy. Right. Sorry, I don't think it's a loss of privacy. So data collection isn't the same as privacy. What is a loss of privacy is the ready access to the data that's been collected.
But by individuals, not necessarily by algorithms.
Okay, I feel like that's a little incremental step forward in the privacy thing as well, which is it's not just about the data collection, it's about data availability by people that you don't, sorry, people outside of your control. But if anything, it just indicates how difficult it is to think about privacy.
Yeah, seriously.
And it is talked about in a very narrow way that it's just something you have and something that tech companies are taking from you.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be so inadequate to describe this like complicated trade-off between free goods, which we derive so much value from, and things which we almost like emit without much thought. Like if I watch Rick and Morty and then I watch Simpsons and people correlate that people who watch cartoons like other cartoons,
yeah.
This could be seen as a privacy thing, but I don't think that is an adequate way to think about what is happening. Cause I don't care about that information. People can have it. It's just aggregation of user behavior that's thrown into this pool that is anonymizing by almost definition of its size, you know?
Like a good thought experiment there is like, could you have a private society in which every book you were going to read was predicted beforehand? It seems like yes, right? It seems like those are not mutually exclusive things.
Oh, that's an excellent thought experiment. But I guess what people are concerned about is the data that's required to get there.
Right.
Has the potential to be abused. And so therein lies the...
I guess the other worry is that people don't think about trade-offs of privacy. They just think, oh, this platform is free and I'm going to join it to be able to talk with my friends. And there I probably have some agreement. Like it seems like it can only be better if people understand, you know, what the model is that allows Facebook to make money, right? Like, so when he's being interviewed by Congress and whatever that congressman was, like asks Mark Zuckerberg, how does Facebook make money? You know, that's probably not the state of public knowledge about Facebook that is optimal.
And it, like maybe to wind down, like that is one of the, I think, big benefits of this documentary and the time well spent movement in Tristan Harris in general is like recognizing that this thing that we previously thought of as neutral isn't neutral. It's a very powerful technology and people need to be aware of the fact that it has an incentive structure, which I don't want to say doesn't align with our own, but has different goals in mind, and we need to understand these goals.
Yeah, nice. To close out, there's a possible catch-22 at work here that I could see listeners cottoning onto that I think you'll have a way out of, but let me just pose it to you anyway, which is that, suppose we're sitting here in 5 years, our podcast has 1 billion subscribers, and social media is better, whatever that means. People are happier, say, with how they're spending time on it, whatever. There's less complaints about it. One reaction on your part is like, see, I told you, it's not leading to the end of the world. We make incremental improvements as it gets better. But a detractor's possible response is like, well, it was only because of a movie. It was only because of the documentary that things got better, right? That put the necessary pressure on these companies to reform in various ways that made the platforms more manageable. Yeah, I'm just wondering what you think about that. Because there is a role for criticism. It seems like your complaint is that the criticism here is like way too overblown, right? They're making it apocalyptic. But like, yeah, how are you going to evaluate whether this documentary was the sheep's cry or whatever?
I think last time I said, I may have cut that out, but the social media companies have taken on a lot of the criticism from Tristan Harris, and the time well spent movement is a good thing. Apple has a way to track your usage now. You can turn off notifications with much more ease on your cell phones. And in 5 years, I just hope that this process will continue. And so I wouldn't be gloating saying, see, there's no problems, because I've never said, see, there's no problems. I've only ever said that let's be targeted with the problems and let's improve it, but recognize that it's will continue to evolve. So I don't hold the position that there's no problem. I hold the position that there are small problems which we should point out and improve so that the technology continues to work in our favor.
Right.
Well, hopefully I wiggled out of that one.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. I don't know if we said anything useful, but hopefully it was kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll move on to other topics after this. Glad to be here.